Hey everyone, welcome back to The Growth Signal, where we are rethinking the future of customer relationships. My name is Alyssa Nolte.
And I'm Dr. Chris Gray.
And we are going to have a great conversation. So Dr. Chris, tell us, what is your hot take?
All right. So my hot take is everything we buy, every single thing we purchase, no matter how mundane, is based on an emotional need. And emotions are what drive our, ultimately what drive our purchase decisions.
I am so excited about this conversation. My college degree, I wanted to become a psychologist. Oh. I wanted to go into psychology. And then I had parents who worked in corporate America and they said, Alyssa, you don't really want to be a shrink. You don't seem the type of person who can be a therapist. And like, spoiler alert, I was not. So they had me get a marketing degree on top of my psychology degree. And so I spent 4 years studying consumer behavior and being fascinated by the concept of how people buy and the idea that nothing is logical and everything is emotional. So I can't wait to hear your perspective on this.
Yes, absolutely. And that's great. I mean, you're going to love my career path then. It, you know, and the thing is, I actually went all the way through grad school and got my doctorate before I realized I didn't want to be a therapist. So,
oh my God, it's so funny.
You want to earn me on that one.
In hindsight, like I would have been a terrible, I don't have the patience for people. Like I want to shake people and say, just figure it out. And that doesn't work in psychology.
That was, at the end of the day, that was the kind of the factor for me is it's the kind of work that you have to love. Because it is so taxing. It is so draining. It really does take everything you have to make sure that you are not only helping your clients as much as possible, but not harming anyone and not, you know, bringing your own stuff in and all those things. And I, just before I finished my dissertation, I sort of realized like, oh boy, I don't love being a therapist. So I had to find another career path. And that's how I did finish my doctorate, but then started doing some consulting in the business world, and that's how I got my feet wet.
So let's dig right into it. Like, I agree that I kind of believe that nothing is logical. Nobody makes logical decisions. We make an emotional decision, and then we rationalize with logic after, because nobody wants to be told that they've made a decision based on their personal emotions. Everyone wants to be like, I'm strategic. I'm thoughtful. I made a decision based in fact.
Yeah.
So why does that happen, number one? And number two, as people who are trying to build relationships with customers, how can we use this knowledge to sell more deals, win more customers, and ultimately build better relationships with those customers?
Yeah, and that's a great, and there's a lot to like sort of get to within that. But I think that, you know, first of all, we've created this false dichotomy between emotion and reason. As if they are completely separate entities that are mutually exclusive. And the truth is that nothing is purely emotional. Nothing is purely rational. It is far more complex than that. Emotion and reason play into our decision-making. The thing is that emotion is much faster. Our emotional responses, the way we respond to the world, emotions happen much, much more quickly than rational thinking does. And so just by virtue of, you know, the rabbit and the hare, you know, emotion gets its licks in first when we're making decisions. And so, you know, we like to think of ourselves as rational simply because emotion, and when it comes to decision-making, has kind of become vilified in our society. And you know, we literally could not make decisions without emotion.
And we shouldn't, because if you think about like back to our caveman days, if you had to sit there and a lion is coming at you and you said, well, let me think about this logically. Does this lion want to eat me or does it want to eat the antelope behind me? You don't really have time to go through that thought process. You have an emotion of fear. You better run. Right.
Absolutely.
So like we're wired to be emotional.
We are very much wired to be emotional. And it, you know, it's interesting. There's some great work that's been done in the last, I'd say, 5 to 10 years that has really changed the way that the scientific community thinks about emotion altogether. And I'm going to allude to it now, but I will get back to it towards the end of the conversation. But, you know, even the idea that we have emotional reactions has been kind of put into question. Because the new thinking is that our brains actually anticipate what will happen, and we respond emotionally to that prior to the event even occurring. And so, you know, emotion is just so rapid. It is so important to the decision-making process. There was actually, this is decades ago, but a study that was done with people that had damage to the areas of the brain that are most responsible for emotional reactions. And what they found was that when that was not functioning, they had trouble even deciding what to have for lunch, what writing utensil to use, the most mundane things that you would think emotion has nothing to do with. They're unable to make those decisions. And so, you know, emotion really is critical to how we think. And I think when we can take a breath and sort of keep ourselves from villainizing emotion in decision making, we can see how valuable it is. Now, the problem with emotion is that because it is so fast, it can make a lot of errors. And so we always have to be, you know, careful about those errors and, you know, be on top of that as well. That's not a problem per se with emotion being in our decision making. It is us not analyzing that emotional aspect of our decision. Pardon me. One of the things I think is so important when it comes to emotion is that emotion is something that captures attention. When we see or feel something emotionally, it tends to attract our attention. It feels relevant to us when something connects emotionally. Think of how you feel about that. Like when, you know, whether it is something that makes you happy or sad or angry, like it is, you feel it, right? And so emotion is something that is very relevant to us. And if I had to boil down my job over the last 30 years into a sentence or two, I would say my job has been finding ways to help brands be relevant to their customers and to align themselves with the inner lives of their customers. And relevance at the end of the day is what makes the difference between any successful brand and any brand that is not successful. It makes a difference between a salesperson who is fantastic and one who can't meet the numbers. Because in those moments, what we're doing, we're finding ways to be relevant to people. Because if we're relevant, we capture their attention, we get engagement, we are able to influence in a way that actually works for them. And it's so important because our brains are essentially ignoring machines. And I want to just demonstrate that to you for a second and to your listeners as well. And they can do this at home. I'd just like you to wiggle your toes for a second. Just take a second, wiggle your toes. Maybe feel the inside of your shoe or the floor beneath you. Maybe your feet are warm or cold. What does that have to do with marketing, Chris? Well, it actually has everything to do with marketing. Because about 30 seconds ago, you probably weren't thinking about your toes. And all of those same perceptions, all those same sensations that you're having when you direct your attention to your toes are still there. It's just they're not relevant to you in the moment. You're focusing on something else. And because attention is a finite resource, it's something we only have so much to give out at any given moment. Our brains are working furiously behind the scenes in split seconds, usually without any knowledge, you know, conscious knowledge. It works in the background and subconscious to make decisions about what is important in this moment. What do I need? You know, if I'm going to spend these attention dollars, if you will, where am I going to put them? Because I can only put them in so many places at once and I have to make those decisions. So, you know, it's something that, you know, we don't deliberately think, well, I'm not going to think about my toes this morning or this afternoon. Instead, our brain does that for us, and it's called selective attention. That is the number one hurdle for anyone in sales or marketing. And I say that with confidence because here's the thing. If you cannot figure out, if you don't understand, have a really intricate knowledge of how attention works, how to get it, how to maintain it, then you're going to lose any opportunity to communicate with your customers and convince them that your product or service or what have you is the best option for them. Because that your ad, your message, your packaging, whatever it is, if it's not relevant and it's not getting attention, then you may as well not even exist in the mind of the consumer. And so a lot, it's when I do like the workshops and the masterclasses that I lead, the psychology of attention is one of the very first modules that we talk about. Because if we don't get that right, none of the rest matters.
Right. So you could be the very best in the world, but if nobody knows you exist, then you might as well not exist.
1000%, right? And you could have the most beautiful marketing message, right? But if it's not getting attention, not only if it's not attracting attention, but if it's not engaging attention over time, then it just, it may as well not exist. It's just like your toes, which you probably already forgot about.
Yeah, I did.
Right? Me too. And so I think that when we think about how to get attention, there's really two key ways to do that. And there may be others, but these are really the two big ones in marketing in particular. The first is what we typically think of, which is disruption, right? So disruption simply means something stands out against its environment somehow, or its background somehow. That's why school buses are bright yellow. That's why ambulances have sirens, so that they get our attention very, very quickly. In an instant, it's hard to ignore. And that's great. And disruption can be a very important strategy in marketing for the immediate term or the very short term.
Yeah. It feels like something you can't sustain, right? Like you can only disrupt X number of times before it just becomes noise.
100%. I always say today's disruption is tomorrow's clutter, right?
Love that.
And here's why. Because just because something gets our attention for an instant doesn't mean that it's meaningful to us. Our brain is still working behind the scenes to say, is this meaningful? Is it relevant? Is it not? And even if you get their attention for a split second, which is all that disruption promises or can deliver on, is an instant. And now, don't get me wrong, that's a huge advantage in a very busy marketplace. But if the brain behind the scenes says, "Hey, it's still not relevant," it's going to move on to something else, and you've lost your moment. And so this is where relevance comes in. And the cool thing about relevance, this is the other one. So there's disruption and there's relevance. The cool thing about relevance is, well, there's a couple of things. One is that it doesn't require disruption to attract attention, because relevance is in and of itself something that is attention getting. Something's meaningful to us, we tend to pay attention to it. We're drawn toward. And the second thing is that relevance not only attracts attention, it maintains attention. And so when we have the 1-2 punch of disruption plus relevance, that's extremely powerful, because we can use something, we stand out against the environment and deliver immediate some relevance that keeps that attention. And now we're in the game. Now we've got the opportunity to, tell them about our product or service, convince them that it's a better option, motivate them to buy. We have all those opportunities that do not exist if we don't have their attention in the first place. And so that is the number one thing I want anyone in sales and marketing to think about, is how do I not only get attention, how can I maintain it with the people that I want to influence? And go ahead.
I would say one thing I want to pick your brain on, and I work with companies of all sizes, so from the startup all the way to the enterprise. And one common thread that I see, no matter what size company you are or the amount of resources or marketing gurus who sit on your team, is this that they forget that they don't get to define what is relevant.
Yes, 100%.
Because there's so many people that I work with that are like, oh, this is relevant to them because of X, Y, and Z and A, B, and C. And I actually am victim of this myself, even though I know the answer. Because I recently am working on a product and it was targeted originally at people who work in customer success roles, because a bunch of people are like, oh yeah, I'm in sales and customer success needs this. And I'm in finance and customer success needs this. So I built this product based on what everyone else thought customer success needed. And then when I presented it to customer success, they're like, we don't need this. And even though I thought it was relevant to them and everyone around them thought it was relevant to them, in the moment, they didn't see it. So therefore, it was like absolutely nothing to them.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, I have so much to say. And it's such a great observation. It is, I think, one of the biggest mistakes that we make. And here's the thing. We're all prone to it. There's no shame in it. Like, we're all, you know, we're all prone to what I like to call main character syndrome, right? So we tend to think that the world sees things the way that we do. And when you're in marketing, there's a lot of roles in which that can be a problem. But when you're in sales and marketing, what that does is it handicaps you. Maybe that's not a great word, but it limits your ability to be effective. And the reason for that is there's a great example. I don't know who came up with this, but they said, basically, you ask someone, you know, what's your favorite food? Oh, my favorite food's pizza. Okay, great. Have you ever been fishing? Yes. Okay, what did you use to catch a fish? Well, a worm. Well, why not pizza? Well, worms don't like pizza. But you do, right? So the whole thing of like, just because you love pizza doesn't mean the fish do, right? And that it's a very similar kind of analogy with the customer. And I think that it's always something to keep in mind that even if we're close to our target customer, we are not our target customer. And that means that they're going to come at this differently than we do. And so something that you learn when you're becoming a therapist that I use all the time, I use it myself whenever I'm doing qualitative research or engaging with someone, and I teach it to my clients, is called bracketing. And bracketing essentially, it sounds very simple, but it's incredibly effective, is you, first of all, have to be aware of your presuppositions, your biases, what you anticipate in this engagement with someone else. And you imagine putting brackets around them in your head, and then you imagine setting them aside so that it's a reminder to come at this with fresh eyes. And when you can practice that and do it, what it allows you to do is then be more able to step into their shoes, to see the problem or the issue or the challenge or the opportunity through their eyes versus your own, and try to keep your own perspective out of the way until you need it again. And then you can put it back on. But I do think that, you know, whenever we're making decisions like that, it is so important to literally figuratively try to step into the shoes of your target, because chances are that that's going to be very different. In fact, one thing I do when I work with clients in workshops is I'll ask them to define the challenge on the table. Tell me about the challenge on the table. And they'll say, you know, from the company's perspective or their perspective, what it is. I'm like, okay, now I want you to bracket that out. And I want you to tell me about this challenge or problem or opportunity from your target customer's perspective. How do they see it? And it's amazing how different that can be. And it's that, then that's the gap that we have to bridge, is if you're not seeing it the same as your customer, then you're not going to be as relevant. You're not going to be as meaningful, you're not going to be as engaging, and you're not going to be as influential and motivating to their behavior.
There's so many things in here, and it's so funny because we didn't like pre-meet any of this conversation. And like, there's so many things that you're talking about that I am just seeing over and over and over again. So if we're both seeing it, it has to be real, right? That has to be, you know, two independent people. My recommendation to people always, and this is not meant to be self-serving, although it might come across that way, though, is it is really hard to step into other people's shoes and to drop your own biases and to truly like disassociate from your own goals and objectives. So how do you work with an outside person who can, one, guide you through that? And two, how do you help them like very quickly understand who you are, what you do, what you're trying to achieve, in a way that doesn't pollute their ability to help you see your customer, your real customer, truly, and not the customer you wish you would have?
Right. Well, I think that there's a number of ways to do that, but I think that, you know, using examples of how they're not their customer. And so one thing that I did years ago, and it was hugely successful, was I created this program. And it's basically, usually it can be half day, full day, depending on how deep we want to get into it. But it's a role-playing game, essentially. And I would take clients through this. And this was when I was doing a lot of retail and shopper work. And we called it Shopper Passport. And what we did was the clients were broken into teams of three. And that each team was given a profile of a target customer. And it would have their psychographics, their demographic. But then it would also have things like, this is their living situation. This is their health situation. This is their home life. This is, and it would have all this information about them. And then we would give them a shopping list of about 10 items. And we would actually give them like a gift card. And that's all the money they could spend was their budget. And they knew what that budget was. And we literally took them to the store and made them shop for these items as if they were this person. And then after they had 30 minutes, and then when they came back, they would unpack their groceries and have to justify why they bought the items that they did. And if they didn't buy any items, why was that? If they had to switch out, why was that? And what this did, it was essentially to demonstrate to them how different their customer is than them and how challenging it is to put yourself in their shoes. And it was so successful. I've done it dozens and dozens of times as a result. In fact, a very large CPG company once asked us to take a day to lead this at their national sales and marketing convention with 700 people.
Wow.
And yeah, I think the thing I'm most proud about there is we didn't lose anybody because we were literally putting people on buses and sending them off to the stores and
logistics nightmare. Around.
Oh yeah, it was crazy. It was wild, but it was incredible. But the thing that is amazing with that is how eye-opening it is. And I can't tell you the number of times I would walk into, you know, a conference room where we were going to do this, and you know, people like with their arms crossed and by the end they're just talking animated, like they're so animated and excited about what they've just experienced, and you're talking about like what opportunities this opens for them, because it's really jarring to when you are forced to put yourself into someone else's shoes and work through challenges, right? Yeah. So for example, like we had one profile, her name was Vicky. She was a single mom with two teenage kids. And we deliberately, and we calculated this all out ahead of time, deliberately did not give her enough in her budget to cover the 10 items. And so then they would have to come back and tell us how they made trade-offs, how they made these decisions, what played into them. And it was pretty amazing. And the fun thing, that I always loved to do was, we would always make sure that two or three items would be, items from categories that the company played in. So, so they would be forced to kind of engage with their own categories. And, towards the end, I would just ask, raise your hand, anybody who, bought something in a category that's your brand's category that wasn't your brand, like people like sheepishly putting their hands up. And the point wasn't to shame them. The point was for them to see if there are certain circumstances under which your brand is not going to be chosen, and help them to kind of understand that, not from their perspective, but from their target customer's perspective. So that then that opens up the opportunity to create solutions that do work for them. And so I think that, it does take a lot of work. I think there are definitely ways to do that, where you can help people see that difference. But I think when you experience it firsthand, it's really powerful.
The one thing that struck me as you were talking is that the default seems to be like sitting in a conference room and going through that same exercise, but mentally. And saying, okay, let's imagine, let's visualize, let's map what their daily looks like. But the power of the physical experience and forcing them into that physical experience, I would imagine it's not replicatable truly to what people are doing now, which I guarantee the default is like, let's put together a plan of a journey, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, the difference, and it is something that I say and is a pillar of the work that I do, is experience is undeniable. When you experience it, when you experience it firsthand, it is so powerful. It is so jarring. It's very different than talking about, you know, the challenges that your shopper, your customer may have, versus being put into that scenario and having to make choices that you're going to have to justify yourself. And I think that, you know, really does. And I applaud anyone who's sitting in a conference room saying, hey, we need to think about our customer. I applaud that.
Right. That's a good step.
Yeah, exactly. There's more to the story. And there are additional ways to go about really bringing that home in a way that will affect your judgment, your own assumptions about them. And so I think, you know, it is so important to, one, have experiences that are different than your own, and two, what fuels that is curiosity. And that, you know, perpetual curiosity is one of our core values at The Bikologist, because if you're not curious, you're not learning. And if you stop learning about your customer, you're going to get left behind, because your customer is changing, their choices are changing, the way they make those choices is changing constantly. And if you're not curious about them, if you think you already know everything about them, you're going to get yourself in a lot of trouble.
Well, that seems like the right mic drop moment to leave it on. So, Dr. Chris, considering all the people that you know or that you aspire to know, who is leading the charge? Who else should we be paying attention to?
You know, I'm going to give you a kind of a nerdy answer, but there is a scientist. Her name is Lisa Feldman Barrett. She is a neuropsychologist, and she has absolutely changed the way that I think about emotion. And her work is just revolutionary. So she is amongst the top 1% of cited scientists in the world.
Wow.
Yeah. And she has two books. So one is called How Emotions Are Made, which is a very, I would say it's a very dense book. There's just it's tremendous, but it's a kind of a lot to get through. And then she has a second book called 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. It is literally like maybe 100 pages long. And I have that book so dog-eared and so marked up. Like, it is like, it's amazing how in like 100 pages, she just revolutionized the way that I think. But she has what is called the constructed theory of emotion. We're used to theories of emotion that were developed 100 years plus ago that, you know, emotions are things that are universal, that, you know, we have like from 4 to 6 core emotions that everyone experiences, that we react to things emotionally, that you can tell what emotion someone is feeling by looking at their face. She challenges all of that and turns it on its head. And it is fascinating. The theory of constructed emotion is this idea that our brains are prediction machines. And our brains are constantly predicting what will happen next. And one of the things that does is it allows for a very quick emotional response right out of the gate, because we are primed for that response to happen. And when we get it wrong, then the brain has to like edit, right, and learn. But when we get it right, it helps us to respond quickly. It helps us to, you know, back, you were saying, like, this is something that is hardwired within us, because it had to be. But I really recommend checking out her book. She's also, she does a lot of podcast interviews and things, so you can find her pretty easily. But she is just such a progressive forward thinker. I am just so, every time I see her, I am just so blown away and enamored with her.
Well, I can already tell just from your description that I am also going to be obsessed with her, because I love everything that you're talking about. And I'm just purely fascinated by that. But if someone is hearing this and they're really connecting with you, they want to learn more, they need some help, they want to connect, they want to have a conversation, where can they find you online?
Yeah, a couple of different things. Check me out on LinkedIn is probably a very easy way to do that. So my handle is Dr. Chris, and you can learn about me and what I do. And then you can also check out my website, which is thebikologist.com, B-U-Y-C-O-L-O-G-I-S-T. And there I have in addition to what I do and my everything, I have a section called Perspectives, where it's kind of like a blog type style. And you can check out some of the things I write about. You can also sign up for my newsletter, which is a once a month newsletter where I do a deep dive into some aspect of consumer psychology. So it's not your typical like couple paragraphs. It's a deeper dive. I try to keep it interesting and fun, but I'll take something like attention, for example, or emotional engagement, or influencing without feeling gross, which is, you know, really the crux of what I do. And you'll get the full download of what that's about, why you should care, and how to go practice it.
Well, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I'm going to be thinking about this conversation for weeks to come.
Thank you, Alyssa. It's absolutely been my pleasure. I appreciate it.